जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी, जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी, यशोदानंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यशोदानंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यमुना तीरावन चारी, यमुना तीरावन चारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी, जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्त वृंद, हरे कृष्णा हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे, हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. Jai Radha Vallabha, Radha Vallabha Radhe. Jai Gauranitai, Jai Gauranitai, Gauranitai, Jai Gauranitai. Jai Jagannatha, Jaya Jagannatha, Baladeva, Jaya Subhadra. Jaya Jaya Prabhupad, Prabhupad, Prabhupad. Jaya Prabhupada, Nitai Gaura Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Nitai Gaura Hari Bol.
Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivraja Kacharya
Shrotar Sahib. His Divine Grace, Akhil Charanagarinda Bhakti Vedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Shri Shri Radha Vallabha Ki Jai, Shri Shri Gaurnitai Ki Jai, Shri Shri Jagannath Baladev Subhadramahi Ki Jai, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Itai Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories, all glories, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Naruktamam. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Tato Jaya Mudiraye Nashta Praeshva Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavat Yuttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Nashthiki. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Punishment and Reward of Kali. Text 6. Yaha Tvam Krishne Gate Duram Saha गांधीव धन्वना शोच्य असी अशोच्यान् रहसि प्रहरन् वधम् अर्हसि। यस्त्वं कृष्णे गते दूरम् सह गांडीव धन्वना शोच्योऽस्य शोच्यान् रहसि प्रहरन् वधम् अर्हसि। यस्त्वं कृष्णे गते दूरम् सह गांडीव धन्वना शोच्योऽस्य शोच्यान् रहसि प्रहरन् वधम् अर्हसि। यस्त्वं कृष्णे गते दूरम् सह गांडीव धन्वना शोच्योऽस्य शोच्यान् रहसि प्रहरन् वधम् अर्हसि। यस्त्वं कृष्णे गते दूरं सह गांडीव धन्वना अर्हसि। लेडीज
यस्त्वं
कृष्णे गते दूरं सह गांडीव धन्वना शोच्योऽस्य शोच्यान् रहसि प्रहरन् वधम् अर्हसि। यः ऑन अकाउंट ऑफ त्वं यू रोग कृष्णे लॉर्ड कृष्ण गते हैविंग गॉन अवे दूरम आउट ऑफ साइट सह अलोंग विद गांडीवा द बो नेम्ड गांडीवा धनवना द कैरियर अर्जुन शोच्य कल्प्रिट असी यू आर कंसिडर्ड अशोच्यान इनोसेंट रहसि इन अ सिक्लूडेड प्लेस प्रहरन बीटिंग वधम टू बी किल्ड अर्हसि डिजर्व। ट्रांसलेशन एंड पर्पोर्ट बाय हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद। ट्रांसलेशन यू रोग You dare, do you dare beat an innocent cow because Lord Krishna and Arjuna, the carrier of the Gandiva bow, are out of sight? Since you are beating the innocent in a secluded place, you are considered a culprit and therefore deserve to be killed. Purport. In a civilization, where God is conspicuously banished, And there is no devotee warrior like Arjuna. The associates of the age of Kali take advantage of this lawless kingdom and arrange to kill innocent animals like the cow in secluded slaughterhouses. Such murderers of animals stand to be condemned to death by the order of a pious king like Maharaj Parikshit. For a pious king, the culprit who kills an animal in a secluded place is punishable by the death penalty. Exactly like a murderer who kills an innocent child in a secluded place. Om Jnanati Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padang Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Niti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna. Maharaj Parikshit has apprehended the personality of Kali, who has dressed himself like a king. Maharaj Parikshit, as of now, does not yet know the true identity of this person. He just understands that he appears to be like a king, he has dressed like a king, but by his activities it is clear that he is not a real Kshatriya, because his activities are not compatible with that of a real Kshatriya. A real Kshatriya is supposed to protect those who are meant to be protected, those who are offenseless, helpless, and so on. But here was this person dressed as a king trying to harm a cow and a bull in a secluded place. So Parikshit Maharaj apprehended him and began to rebuke him. And he said, that, how dare you try to harm this cow in this land? Do you think that because Lord Krishna and his dear friend Arjuna are no longer present with us, that you are free to do anything you like and commit all kinds of sinful activities? And because you are committing such a crime of beating or trying to kill an innocent creature in a secluded place, you deserve to die because you are a culprit. So rather strong statement from a leader of a state who wants to punish someone who is killing an animal or harming an animal. Now, this is not something that is considered a heinous crime in the modern society today. Yes, there are societies for prevention of cruelty to animals. And, for example, in our Bhaktivedanta Manor, Goshala in London, One time when there was a cow who had a certain disease which had the potential of being contagious, then the government actually came down on them and said that you have to kill the cow. You have, painlessly, of course, you inject something or whatever and you have to kill the cow. And the devotees carried out a big campaign. And somehow or the other they managed to salvage the situation. They tried to treat the cow or whatever. I don't know what they did exactly, but the point is that in the name of preventing cruelty, they actually want to kill the cow. But when it comes to slaughterhouses, they are there by the dozens. So this is a strange contradiction. On one hand, they talk about prevention of cruelty to animals, and on the other hand, they open slaughterhouses for large-scale slaughter of animals, large-scale eating of meat. So today, the eating of flesh or animals or killing of animals is something quite ordinary. In fact, in most countries of the world now, you can't get proper vegetarian food. And those of you who travel to different places, you know how difficult it is. In many countries of the world, people do not have any concept of what vegetarian food is. They just do not understand the term. They cannot conceive in their imagination that something like this can exist, that there can be people who will not eat animals or birds or seafood or whatever. So different devotees describe their experiences and they say how when they go to some of these places, they ask for a vegetarian, 100% vegetarian food, and to be safe and 100% safe, just give me a salad. And even then, after, upon deep inquiry, you find out that they put all kinds of fish oil on top of that. So they just have no concept. So the idea of killing an animal for the sake of food has become such an everyday idea, something so natural, that to even think that such a thing could be a crime is very strange. It just doesn't fit into the idea of most people in this world. And therefore the situation in the world goes from bad to worse. The principle of cruelty is something they can't understand. And even when they do, they try to adjust that and accommodate that by trying to kill or make the killing of the animals in the slaughterhouse as painless as possible. They call it stun killing or whatever it is they do. They stun the animal first. It's something like anesthetizing a patient before you cut the patient up for a surgery. So they stun the animal and then kill so that the animal doesn't feel the pain. Or at least it feels minimal pain. So there are so many such fallacies that exist. And factually, human beings do not need to kill animals to survive. And neither do they even need to kill animals to be healthy. The elephant is quite strong. Very strong. It doesn't eat meat. There are many animals in nature who are quite strong, despite being vegetarian. There are many humans who are doing quite well eating vegetarian diets. They are healthy, they are strong, they are going about their work happily. What about the principle of cruelty? People don't consider that. Even many religions, they talk about mercy, how God is merciful. But when they are asked about killing of animals and how it violates the principle of mercy, they feel that the animal is game. It's all right because the animal is not considered a living entity on the platform of a human being. And then Prabhupada was talking to one such person, and in that conversation when this argument was put forward by this person, Prabhupada replied, How can you say the animal is not conscious? The animal eats, you eat. The animal sleeps, you sleep. When you are attacked, you protest. When the animal is attacked, the animal protests. The animal shouts or screams in fear, in trying to protect itself. So the symptoms are all common. So how can you say that the animal is not conscious? The only difference is that the body of the animal provides for a lower degree of development of intelligence and consciousness. Otherwise, they're all the same living entities, spirit souls, occupying different bodies. So we have no right to destroy these living entities, their homes. Even if we argue that we are not the body, and therefore killing the body is not a crime, but destroying somebody's house, Prabhupada said, it's a crime. If I come and destroy the house and you protest and I say, well, I'm not harming you, I'm just destroying your house, but it's still a crime. It's still a very grave crime. So any which way that we look at it, there is no justification for the killing of animals. And of course, it's a big topic, a topic by itself. But as we were mentioning yesterday, the animals are also considered citizens because they are born in the land. Everyone who is born in the land must be given protection. Just like the eyelid in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is explained. Just like the eyelid is a protector of the eye, the parents are protectors of the children. The grihasthas, the householders, are protectors of the wandering mendicants. Similarly, the kings are meant to be the protectors of all the citizens. The sons of King Prachina Barhishat were sent by the king to perform austerities in preparation for their coming back and taking over their royal responsibilities. They performed austerities for many, many years. They were guided by Lord Shiva. And ultimately they attained perfection and the Lord, Supreme Lord, actually appeared before them and blessed them. And then they came out again. They did penances under the water for thousands of years. Such things were possible in that age, Satya Yuga. And when they emerged from the water after many, many thousands of years, they saw that the earth was overgrown with all kinds of trees and vegetation. And there was no place left for agriculture, no place left for human beings, because the trees had overgrown everything. So they became annoyed that these trees have occupied every inch of space. So what about the poor animals and the humans? What are they going to do? So they started burning down these trees by their glance. Such was the power of their austerities. And the demigod in charge of the trees and plants is Soma, the moon god. So he came hurriedly when he saw that everything was being burnt down. Forest fires much bigger than the forest fires here. And Soma said, don't do this. And that's when he quoted this. And he said, look, you're meant to be future kings of this planet. And the trees are also your citizens. So you have an obligation to protect them. So that's a fact. And we see simple examples of this sort even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, many, many such instances. When a great king called Shibi was approached by a bird who was a dove, for protection, because the dove was being chased by an eagle who wanted to eat it. So the king said, you are my citizen, so I will protect you. So you come and be under my protection. So the dove was feeling very safe and secure. So then the eagle came chasing. And as soon as the eagle arrived, King Shibi said, no, you can't touch this dove, because this dove is under my protection. It's my citizen. Its life is in danger. So it is my duty to protect this dove. Now the eagle was very intelligent. So he said, but my dear king, I am also your citizen. And this is my food by nature's arrangement. So if you deprive me of my food, then I will die. So inasmuch as it is your duty to protect the life of this dove, this bird, it is also your duty to protect me. So King Shibhi realized this was a good argument, a good point. Can you imagine such a discussion taking place in the modern times? So King Shibhi replied, all right, you are correct. I have to protect your life as well. I have to arrange for your sustenance. So what I will do is, I will cut off flesh from my body equal to the weight of this dove. And then I will give it to you, so that you can sustain your body. And then when he was about to do that, the birds manifested themselves in their true form. They were demigods who had come to test King Shibhi. So this is the extent to which the kings would go to protect their citizens. The kings were so selfless and dedicated for their subjects that they would go to any lengths. Similarly, King Rantidev also, when he was about to break his fast after a long time of fasting, he was approached by a variety of entities, from a Shudra to a Chandala to a dog, and each time he kept giving them the prasadam and he had nothing left. And the last when someone came, he wanted to give that away even. And he had nothing to eat, he would have starved. But nevertheless, he just gave it. He said, it's my duty, it's the duty of the king to live for the welfare and well-being of others. So he gave away the prasadam. Then again, all these entities manifested their true form. They were also demigods who had come to test him and to glorify him actually. So this is the nature of kings. This is the spirit of sacrifice that was found in the Vedic times. There was a sage called Dadhichi. One time the demigods approached him and they said, we are in trouble because the asuras are constantly harassing us and our lives are in danger, our kingdoms and properties and family members are in danger. So please help us. We have come to know that the only way we can protect ourselves is by getting a weapon fashioned from your bones. Because your bones, there's something special because of the austerities you have performed. So this is what we have been informed. So we want your bones. Now you can't give somebody your bones when you're alive. You have to die. Then from your dead body they can take the bones. So Dadhichi said, no problem. Without hesitation, he said, yes, take my bones. He was willing to give it. This is Vedic culture. This is the spirit of sacrifice, where we do something for the welfare of others. And there's no hesitation. So how much more for the king, who is supposed to be the protector of everyone? The sages were also the protectors of the citizens. And therefore, killing any living entity was considered a crime. Whether it's what to speak of a human being, even a tree or a bird or an animal. And those who were more helpless deserved more protection. So the punishment was more stringent when the living entity or the subject was helpless or offenseless. And especially killing a cow or an innocent animal in a secluded place is like, as Prabhupada explains, a murderer who kills an innocent child in a secluded place. Not that killing a child in a crowded place is all right, but the fact that you take him to a secluded place makes it even more severe. It's more punishable. And the interesting point is that Parikshit Maharaj says, Vadham Arhasi, you deserve to be killed. In other words, the Vedic culture spoke about the death penalty, capital punishment. What to speak of for murders of human beings? Definitely that deserved a death penalty. But even for killing of a cow, we are hearing about the death penalty. The king says you deserve to be killed, and Prabhupada confirms this. For a pious king, the culprit who kills an animal in a secluded place is punishable by the death penalty, exactly like a murderer who kills an innocent child in a secluded place. Today there is a vast movement going on all over the world to abolish the death penalty. And many countries have abolished this. And they consider it a sign of civilized society to not have the death penalty. Many arguments have been put forward in favor of abolishing this penalty. For example, they say that there is no data or no proof to show that by imposing the death penalty, there is any deterrent to others to perform similar crimes. Because one of the ideas is that if you extend the death penalty as a law, then other people will be afraid to do some crimes because they are afraid of death, that they will be killed. But then the argument goes that where are the statistics? Where is the proof that by having the death penalty, you actually are deterring other people from doing similar crimes? There is no such proof, they say. The second point they say is that the death penalty offered by the state is just a kind of sophisticated state-sponsored revenge. Because he has done a crime, so then you avenge that crime by killing this person. But instead of the victim or the victim's family doing that, the government does it. So it's like revenge. So, well, there are arguments like this put forward. These two arguments are not actually very good arguments. The only argument that is a good argument that they put forward really is that there is uncertainty about who has killed. If there's a murder and we don't really know, we're not sure who has killed such and such person, and there is a possibility in this age of Kali when people's intelligence is not pure and everything is corrupted and so on, that the courts may make a mistake. Or the judicial system may be manipulated or corrupted in some way. It's possible in many countries that this could happen. So there could be a genuine mistake, or a deliberate mistake even, and a wrong person may be condemned to die. That may happen. That is the only strong argument in favor, actually speaking, of abolishing the death penalty. But ideologically or theoretically, the other arguments are not valid. And sometimes we see in the Vedic culture also there was some mistaken identities like this. You know who was Vidura in the previous life? Vidura was a sage called Manduka. Manduka Muni. And actually, so he was not a sage, he was actually, anyway, I'll come to the point. So there was a king. In his kingdom, there was a sage who somehow was sitting peacefully in his ashram. And there was a thief who came along and he was being chased by the king's soldiers. And the soldiers came and they accosted this sage and they thought that he was shielding the thief. And they thought that he was a thief. The sage was actually innocent. And they wrongly punished him. And they were about to kill him as a punishment. And that's when the king came to know. And just in time, in the nick of time, the king prevented this from happening. So the sage, Manduka, he wasn't angry with the king. He said, well, yes, your soldiers have made a big blunder, But actually, I'm not angry with you. I'm angry with Yamaraj, the one who dispenses justice. So he cursed Yamaraj and said, why is it that I had to be subjected to this? Being up there and being killed, just on the point, on the verge of being killed, why did this happen? You know, so it's obviously a blunder you have made. And then Yamaraj asked his assistants, bring out the data and, you know, all the history sheets, and said, well, you see, Manduka Muni, when you were a child, you had impaled an insect with a sharp blade of grass. So because of that karma, you know, you were destined to be killed, or at least threatened to be killed with a sharp spear and punished in this way. So Manduka Muni said, but that's not reasonable. A little child is innocent. A little child may do so many things, but to take the misdemeanor or a mistake of a child so seriously and then enforce a death penalty on him is something very foolish. So therefore I curse you, because your whole system is like that of a Shudra. You should become one in the next life. And so then poor Yamaraj had to become Vidura. Vidura, who was a brother of Dhritarashtra and Pandu. So there are mistakes that happened even in the Vedic times. We also see instances of maybe people coming for the wrong, Yamaraj's agents coming for the wrong people, but then they realize the mistakes in time and they come back. You have instances of these people who have these near-death experiences, and they after a while they come back and they relate their experience and they say, well, you know, there was some argument going on. They said, people said, oh, he's not the wrong one, he's the wrong one. And then he becomes conscious again and comes back to life. And of course, these things rarely happen, very rarely. Well, there is a chance of a mistake, but nevertheless, the ideology or the principle behind the death penalty is something that is important to understand. When one kills another living entity, then it is a grave sin. And as a result of that sin, one has to suffer in the hellish planets for a long time. Even small sins invoke a lot of punishment. So what to speak of grave sins like killing? So if one commits a murder, then one will suffer in hell for a long time. But if one is punished with a death penalty, then one is absolved, one is relieved of the need to go to hell. The entire sinful reaction is nullified by this one act of hanging that culprit or killing that culprit. So at one stroke, you've relieved that person of that sin. And also, yes, you have sent out a message to the society that this is not a society where anything goes, where you can kill and murder and get away with it. It is misplaced compassion to take a murderer and then keep him, especially a very deliberate murderer. It's one thing when you murder somebody in self-defense, that is not considered a murder. Or there are other circumstances when killing somebody may be justified. But in normal circumstances, like the circumstances which this person was trying to harm a cow, those killings are not justified. So nowadays, if such people are arrested and they are at the most given life imprisonment, and even then it's not for the entire life. They call it life imprisonment, but they give it only for maybe 15 years or 20 years. And then the person is out again after a while, even after he is considered committed very heinous crimes. And in many occasions, the prisons are very comfortable. They're equipped with so many different comforts. And we know of instances where prisoners prefer to be in the prison because at least they get proper food, they get food to eat, and they don't have to worry about earning a livelihood. It happens like that. So what happens is then that people who are aggrieved, they will start to feel that what is happening here? This person has killed members of my family and he's out after 15 years and everything is all right. But of course, giving the death penalty is actually a sign of compassion. But yes, the practical problems are indeed there because of the current judicial system. In the earlier ages, justice was swift, justice was correct. And you had people who had such sharp intelligence that they could immediately understand a given situation just by hearing and looking. When people came forward, they could understand what is what and give a correct judgment. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it is said, he was also a magistrate and he would take decisions very quickly because he would understand what was what. He could and make his decisions, judicial decisions, very quickly. But nowadays in Kali Yuga, especially as this age progresses, everything is so complicated. It's very hard to determine who is right and who is wrong. When you have two parties with a conflict coming to you, both seem really very convincing. And you're not able to understand who is right and what happened and who is speaking the truth, who is lying, and who is speaking how much of the truth and not speaking an inconvenient part of the truth. Because everyone likes to present that part of the truth which supports him or her. So in Kali Yuga, justice has become a very complicated thing. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 12th canto, it is said that in Kali Yuga, justice will be meant for those who are powerful. In other words, those who are powerful will get justice, what they think is justice. Whatever the powerful want for themselves will be justice. So those who really need justice, those who are powerless, offenseless, helpless, will not get justice. In the Vedic culture, medical care, education, and justice were sublime and given free to all citizens. It was their right. Timely and correct justice was also given. In Kali Yuga, ironically, it is these three things that have become the most expensive. Medical care is so expensive now. Even if you have the health system of the government, but you have to wait for a long time. We have a doctor here. You agree? It's a very expensive thing. Education in the university, so expensive. And legal fees, oh, so expensive. So those things which were in the early ages given freely, that was a duty of the king to offer this to the citizens, now has become very, very difficult. Of course, as far as medical care is concerned, it was the vaidyas, the doctors, who were actually sages. So they lived in their ashrams and they treated patients who came free. They were brahmanas and they were given dakshina, some donations by people. They managed their life. The kings had their own doctors in their palace and they would be full-time there looking after the king and they were well-maintained by the king. And as far as the other doctors were concerned, the citizens would come and give dakshina donation and they would get maintained. But it was never done as a business. It was always done as a service. And many, many others would come and learn and they would go away. This was a system of the Vedic culture. In today's age of Kali Yuga, all this is happening because society is becoming ungodly. And that is the very first sentence in Srila Prabhupada's purport here, where he says, in a civilization where God is conspicuously banished, it's a nice way of putting it, very, very true and to the point. In a civilization where God is conspicuously banished and there is no devotee warrior like Arjuna, the associates of the age of Kali take advantage of this lawless kingdom and kill innocent animals. Yeah, this is an indication that the demoniac population is increasing. The demoniac person doesn't know, according to the Bhagavad Gita, what is to be done and what is not to be done. Pravrittimcha navrittimcha janana vidurasuraha. Na satyam napi chacharo, na satyam teshu vidyate. So Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 16th chapter that those who are demoniac by nature, they do not know what should be done and what should not be done. Na shaucham, they have no cleanliness. Na cha acharaha, they don't know what is proper behavior. Na satyam, there is no truthfulness in them. Asatyam apratishtham te jagat anishvaram ahu. They see this world is false, it has no foundation. There is no God here. Jagat anishvaram. Ishvara means the Lord. Anishvara means without God. They say there is no God in this world. The only foundation is lust. Kama hitukam. And everything is going on simply because of lust. Eta drishtim avashtabhya nashtatmanolpa ugrakarmanah prabhavantya ugrakarmanah kshayayo jagatohitah. So Krishna explains that with such a vision, itam drishtim, with such a conception of life, nashtatmanolpa buddhayah, such people with less intelligence, alpa buddhayah, they perform horrible acts that are meant for destruction of the world. Kshayaya jagatah. Ahitaha, which are unbeneficial works, is called ugra karma. So ugra karma refers to these destructive acts performed by a demoniac population that actually is very harmful for the entire world. So this is the symptom of the modern demoniac civilization, which conspicuously banishes God. This is the secular world, the secular government, the secular principles of governance, which want to keep God out of the picture. But that is a very artificial form of governance, because you cannot banish God from the lives of the people. Because the urge for God is something very fundamental. Governments have tried it in the past. It has not worked. Communism tried to banish God officially as part of their ideology. But then it was always there. And when communism collapsed after maybe half a century, maybe almost a century, then you find places of worship and religious movements flourishing. Religion is flourishing in those countries like Russia and so on. Because you can't suppress something that is a natural urge of living entities. And in fact, in philosophy, this is a kind of an argument to prove that God exists. Because nature is complete and perfect. So for every plus, there's a minus. For every minus, there's a plus. For every need, there is a fulfillment. So the fact that I'm thirsty means that water must exist somewhere to fulfill that thirst. The fact that hunger exists means that food must exist somewhere to satisfy that hunger. So for every need, there is a fulfillment. The existence of the need indicates the existence of something that will fulfill that need. Because the argument is that nature is perfect and complete and there is harmony. So similarly, it is an undisputed fact that from time immemorial, there have been people who have been seekers of God, cutting across all religious traditions, all faiths and cultures and countries and languages. You've had people who have gone to great lengths to seek God. Many have left home. Many have undergone very severe austerities. Some have lived in forests. Some have gone to monasteries. Some have sacrificed their lives. Some have been persecuted and killed by others, but they never gave up their belief. So this urge for God, which prompts people to do so many things, a very strong urge. It's a fundamental urge, just like the urge to eat, the urge to drink. So therefore, the fact that the urge for God has existed in history from time immemorial means that God must exist. And just like curbing hunger, can you banish hunger? Banish hunger. How is that possible? So long as the body is there, there will be hunger, there will be thirst. You can't banish hunger because it's a natural thing for the body. So similarly, if you banish God, it's a very unnatural thing. You're trying to banish something that is an intrinsic nature of the living entity. Because we are basically spiritual living beings. So trying to banish God is something that is not at all a productive thing and helpful for the civilization. So today's secular world, therefore, promotes only a demoniac type of behavior. And this sort of killing and slaughter of animals goes on. And because there is no God, there is no scripture, and because there is no scripture to regulate and guide human society, then people speculate about what is right and what is wrong. And as Devamrita Maharaj was very nicely explaining the other day, that your conception of good is wrong for me, my conception of good is wrong for you, it's all relative, we keep differing with each other, and therefore our ideas of what is good and what is wrong, what is right and incorrect, we keep changing. It's all very relative. So we concoct our solutions and doesn't give us any satisfaction or doesn't solve our problems. So we end up with all these things where there were contradictions, where they will slaughter animals en masse and then talk about civilization. They will talk about being refined and cultured and protect RSPCA, Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and Wildlife Protection and so on. They will protect the pandas in China in some corner of the forest or some animals which are endangered species, and they will do a big thing about it, but they will eat meat at home. Why don't you talk of protection of the poor animals you are killing for your food? It's fine to, we're not against the pandas, poor things, we want them to live too. Pandas or kangaroos or wallabies or whatever it is, let them live, we have no problem. They should live, they are God's creatures. But then you want to protect one species, one animal, and give you dedicate your life for the protection of that one animal, probably you'll become that in the next life. And then you have no qualms or compunctions in killing some animal to eat for food. So these are the logical conundrums or the contradictions in which modern society finds itself because it has become godless. So therefore the Srimad Bhagavatam is very important. We need to introduce the principles and the philosophy and the practices of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then we will have a sane, sober and stable society. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
How can we avoid becoming affected or depressed by hearing about so many bad things that are happening all the time?
Okay, the question is, how can we avoid becoming depressed by hearing about so many bad things that go on all the time? The answer is very simple. Spend a lot of time hearing about all the good things that are happening in Krishna consciousness as well as in the scriptures. Read about Krishna's pastimes, read about Krishna's messages, read Prabhupada's stories and all the acharyas about the great devotees in the past and how wonderfully they served Krishna. Also hear about all the nice preaching and the services that the other devotees are doing in Melbourne and also in other places. So that will be very inspiring. If we're only hearing the negative things about this world, yes, we will feel depressed. But then we have the solution, the Srimad Bhagavatam. We have Krishna. So when we have Krishna, then everything is positive, everything is happy. Right? Yes.
They were discussing how we need to protect all the animals, everything. How do we deal with pests and rodents which eat away food grains and also cause diseases in modern times? How was this treatment in many times? Can you give me a reference?
Yeah. Tricky question, huh? How do you deal with rodents and insects which cause diseases and so on? And what was the principle in ancient times? You know, Prabhupada used to give the example of his father, who was a businessman. He had a cloth shop. And rats would come and nibble at the cloth. And so naturally, the merchandise would be spoilt. He couldn't sell that cloth anymore, so it caused loss in his business. So what he would do was, he kept some food specially for the rats. So they would come and eat that food and leave alone the cloth. So rats were happy. They wouldn't disturb the business. And then things went on nicely. Actually, at another level, let's talk about the farmer in the field. Today's farmer or today's society feels that it is humanity alone that has a right to the produce of the field. But that's not so. The insects, the birds, they also have a right. It is God's property. By God's arrangement, these crops are growing. So we have many enlightened farmers who will provide a facility for some other such insects or birds and so on to come and also partake of that. They have their share as well. It's not that humanity, 100% of the share is reserved for humans. The animals, insects, birds also have the rightful claim on the property of our common eternal Father, Krishna. So yes, something should be left aside for them too. Therefore, the Vedic scriptures talk about how we should also feed the animals, not keep them in your house. You shouldn't keep dogs in the house, for sure. But yes, you are supposed to feed them and maintain and protect the animals. They have a right too. And it's part of the Grihastha Dharma, according to the Vedic culture, to do that. But of course, where animals were causing harm, injury, and so on, then the humans have a right to protect themselves, inasmuch as they would if another human attacked them. So we have to see it in a balanced way like that. I remember one devotee asking this question, what to do about mosquitoes who bite you? I don't think you have mosquitoes so many here in Australia, but there are many countries where the mosquitoes are really something else.
There are spiders here.
Yeah?
The spiders.
What?
The spiders.
Spiders.
In Australia.
Australia, you have spiders. Okay. So they make a lot of webs. So, and this devotee had an interesting argument. You see, in the Bhagavad Gita purports, Prabhupada mentions that from the laws of Samhita, Manu Samhita, there are certain categories of people who can be legitimately killed. One who comes to burn your house, so on and so forth. And one of them is one who attacks you with a sharp weapon. You know? So mosquito is one who comes and attacks you with a sharp weapon and sucks your blood. So can we kill the mosquito? He's an aggressor. The best solution, of course, is to, as far as cockroaches and other entities, keep your place clean so that these living entities will not be inclined to come in. But if your surroundings are not clean or if you have a field and so on, there's bound to be something. So to some degree you have to tolerate it and go on. But you can do things to keep them away rather than to kill them, as far as killing is an absolutely last option. There are ways you can prevent them from coming in, keeping things clean. There are certain plants you can plant. Like, for example, you want to keep rats away, you plant the Glericidia. The rats don't like the smell of the Glericidia plant, so they stay away. Or mosquitoes don't like the smell of certain other plants, you know, some fragrance or whatever it is that they don't like, they stay away. So we can do things like that which don't necessarily involve killing. All right? Any other question? Yes.
One comment, Mother. Srila Prabhupada's example of compassion.
Yes.
Shruti Hari was the servant at that time. So Prabhupada was doing meditation and there was a small insect crawling under the lotus petal. So he called the servant, "Can you take this animal out?" He said, "Where is the animal? I can't see." The Prabhupada said, "That is crawling under the petal of the lotus. Take him out and put him in the garden." This is extreme compassion.
Yes, it goes to show how Prabhupada was so careful about the smallest things. You heard the story of Mrigari. Once he became a devotee, he was even hesitant to step over ants. But of course, another thing we must remember also is that as devotees, we may be avoiding killing animals, of course, and even avoiding killing insects, but we may be very harsh to our fellow devotees. Yes? So then that kind of compassion, also what good is that? I protect the pandas and I protect the kangaroos and I protect cows and I protect everything, but to the devotees, psh, 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 psh. I am cruel to the devotees by my words and my actions. That's also a contradiction. Not that we should prevent cruelty to animals, but be cruel to devotees. Any other question? Yes.
Prabhupada said that you glance at consciousness just as you move into consciousness. So on the same line, not maybe disagree, yes, they do perhaps have the consciousness that we can move into. But then they say that even plants have the same consciousness, like they grow, they take food from the soil and they need sunlight to grow, and so then we should make plants also then what they need.
The question is that plants also have consciousness, so we shouldn't eat plants then because they're certainly they are living entities and they are conscious. But jivo jivasya jivanam, the Srimad Bhagavatam explains that it is nature's arrangement, Krishna's arrangement, that one species in this world lives on another species. So for human beings, the designated food is vegetarian food, plant food. Prabhupada used to say, the tiger does not come to eat your fruit. So why do you go to eat the tiger's food, which is the animal? And Prabhupada said, even if you do want to do that, then you should also eat the animal like the tiger does. Jump on the animal and tear it up with your claws and your teeth and eat. But that's meant for the animal. So every species has a designated food by the Lord's arrangement for survival. So we kill the plants. But even in eating vegetarian food, in many cases there is no killing. When you have milk, nuts, fruits, and many, many other products, there is no killing. In one discussion, Srila Prabhupada also mentions that grains, after a while, then they die, and then you harvest and you eat, then there's no killing. But even when there is killing, yes, there is some violence. But that violence is very, very insignificant compared to the violence that is caused when you kill an animal. So Prabhupada used to say, do you think that killing a cow and killing a potato is the same thing? Both are conscious, but there's a difference. The consciousness of the animal is more evolved. It's very much more evolved. There is much more pain that is caused to the animal, so the karma is much more. There is pain caused to the plant as well, but it is much lesser. And at the end of the day, we are not even into being vegetarians. Because you are right, there is some sin involved in that, at least partly. So we are prasadatarians. We offer vegetarian food to Krishna. Yajna shishtashina hasanto muchyante sarva kilbishai bhunjate te tvagam papa ye pachantyatma karanat. Food that is not offered as sacrifice to Krishna is considered sin. When we eat remnants of food offered in sacrifice to Krishna, then that purifies us. So we take vegetarian food, which is the food designated for us by Krishna, because we have to survive, we have to eat something. So that is the food Krishna has set aside for us to survive, so we do that. But after doing that, we offer it to Krishna. And when we offer it to Krishna, then it becomes purified of whatever sinful reactions there may have been. And that prasadam, that becomes prasadam, pure spiritual food. So we take that, and we don't have any of the karmic reactions. Rather, we get spiritualized by that prasadam. Okay? Yes.
So, as devotees, even though we are not doing these activities, are we going to get some reactions from that? And like some things we can see, like no food crisis or natural calamities, and then how we can deal with that?
The question is that even though individually we may not be performing some of these sinful activities, other people are doing it, but will we also suffer because of that to some degree? Yes. There is individual karma and there is collective karma. So a country as a whole, a society as a whole, the world as a whole has to suffer sometimes the results of a few people. So to some degree that's also part of our karma, because we are living here at this day and age in this circumstance when somebody else is doing this havoc. So yes, something is there. We have to bear the problem of being around and having to hear about all these things all the time to see it. But at least if we practice Krishna consciousness nicely and spread the good word everywhere, we are doing something very substantial for solving the problems of the world permanently. One last question, if anyone has. Yes.
What does Islam say in terms of meat eating?
What does Islam say about meat eating? I'm not an expert on that subject. But I can say that it's not just scriptures from other religions that may permit animal killing. Even the Vedas permit animal killing. There are sections in the Vedas that allow people to kill animals and eat meat. There are sections in the Vedas that allow people to drink alcohol. So there is a wide variety of scriptures in the Vedic house, so to speak. And they're meant for people in different modes, with different mentalities. On one end of the spectrum, you have the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is meant for the Paramahamsas, who are transcendental to the three modes of material nature. And because Krishna is very kind, he wants to have regulatory books, even for those who are in the lowest modes of ignorance. So he provides some instructions for them as well. So the other end of the spectrum, you have injunctions and scriptures for those who are in the mode of ignorance. Those who are really attached to eating meat, to drinking alcohol and so on, he makes a provision for them as well. But what he does is, he says, there are certain procedures you have to follow, which are given in the scriptures. So when you follow those scriptures, you are doing these sinful activities, but because you're doing it according to the instructions of the Vedic scripture, you're gradually purified. After many lifetimes, you come to the point when you realize, I shouldn't be doing this. Because you're doing it under authority. It isn't the best thing to do. It's a kind of a sanction that's given. Not that the Lord wants us to do it. He permits us to do it because we are obstinate, because we are stubborn. Out of His mercy, He says, okay, you're going to do it anyway. All right, so I'll create a facility for you. Do it in an organized way, in the way that I'm saying, and then gradually you'll come out of it. So is there even in the Vedic scriptures, not just the scriptures of the other religions in the world. Okay, so thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Premanande.